Green from San Diego.
Hi, I'm Doreen. I'm an alcoholic.
Doreen.
Oh, I'm really nervous. I just want to say before I start, this actually turned out to be a really sad day for me. After Randy invited me to do this, I got an announcement that today was the memorial service for a sponsee who went out and who died of liver and kidney failure. And that's where I spent the afternoon. And, you know, you stay sober for a while, you get to go to some funerals. And if you... have an idea in your head that you might just get to go out and come back, you just might not get to come back, you know? You just might not get to come back. And so I know you're supposed to start with a joke, but I got to say that today I'm very baffled. You know, I'm baffled. I don't know why she didn't get a miracle and I did. And I wish... You know, I've been like lying in bed thinking, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? It's going to be great. I'm going to tell people how to... I'm just going to give them the key. And the truth is, I don't know what the key is. You know, I know what I did. And my sobriety date is October 18th, 1998. And I have not had a drink and I have not had a mind-altering drug since then. And I know that and I'll tell you how I did it. But I don't know why it works. And sometimes it's... Well, I have a PhD and it bothers me. That's the truth. to have the most important thing in my life be something so mysterious to me. You know, it's so mysterious to me what has happened in my life and why some people get it and some people don't. But I believe that a miracle has happened in my life. And I believe I've had the chance to live two lives in one lifetime. And that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a chance to be, you know, I like to say the woman I never wanted to be, but a woman I never even thought I could be. Like, it never crossed my mind that I could be who I am today because I was constitutionally sad. You know, I was just an unhappy person, always. And that I would be a happy person with pastels in my closet never occurred to me. It was like a different breed of person, you know. But let me tell you my story, what it was like, what happened, and I hope I get sober really fast from the story because what I really want to talk about is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are to me the most amazing and important thing in my life, really, what's happened to me working the steps. I think I probably had a pretty good upbringing, you know. It's hard to know because I have a disease of perception. And so if I tell the story, it's tragic. And no one suffers as much as me. But objectively, you know, I was well-fed and clothed and consistently disciplined and well-educated and learned how to work hard. And, you know, whatever, had a Christmas tree. And I don't know, it was... I don't have a lot to complain about. You know, actually, I was really lucky in a number of ways. I was very lucky, and I was really sad. And there were some things that were hard. You know, okay, I'm really smart. You just have to know that I think that's true. Otherwise, my story doesn't make sense. And my father thought that was true about himself as well. And he had a stroke when I was 12, and then it wasn't true anymore for him. And he spent my teenage years drinking at that. And it seemed to me, because, you know, in a family we all have our roles, the dumb but nice one, you know, the pretty but bad one. And, you know, I was the smart but ugly one, and I felt like he drank at me because I was smart and I was going to college, and he wasn't anymore. And I developed a lot of ways of seeing myself in the world that I thought were true, you know. And so I later came to see them as resentments, but I just thought it was the truth at the time, that I was too smart to be lovable. and that that was it, you know, and that if I would work really hard, I could stay out of the line of fire. Because while my mom was working two jobs and my dad was drinking professionally, I learned that if I did the cooking and the housework, he laid off of me. And that's kind of, you know, my 15-year-old ways are, honestly, they're my default thinking. I believed they were true well into my 30s. That story, they were my beliefs. They were my beliefs. That was my solution. My solution was to work really hard and to prove everybody, to prove them right, you know, that I was smart but unlovable. I think it was kind of my loyalty. And I had one ambition in life, and that was to go to Berkeley. I grew up in Northern California where there's just one school, and and I was going to go to it. And so I, you know, I had my first, the first time I drank when there was enough to get drunk was when I was 15, and I blacked out. I blacked out the first time that I could. You know, we would go out and finish my parents' cocktails or whatever, but the first time I could black out, I did. And I liked it because my head was quiet. So, you know, when I drank, most of the time when I would drink, I would reach a point in the evening when I couldn't remember what had happened. I was always that person who'd be calling you the next day like, hey, that was really funny last night, huh? Remember? Like, what happened? Like, who are you? Where is my car? I don't remember really anything. You know? I was like, I always overshot the mark. I like that feeling like that, you know, when my brain would be quiet. But I would overshoot the mark all the time, and then I'd be in blackout. And I like to tell you what I really thought about you. I grew up with a mean drunk for a dad, and I became a mean drunk myself pretty quickly. But what I want to tell you is I didn't really drink through college because my solution was to get into Berkeley and get out of Berkeley. And that took on my part a lot of work. And I would drink at the end of the semester. I'd black out for a few days, and then, you know, that was my plan. And I worked really hard at it, and I did. I graduated with honors from Berkeley, and then I collapsed because I didn't have a plan beyond that. You know, that was all I'd ever done, was get into Berkeley and get out of Berkeley. And I had no idea what to do. You know, I didn't know who I was. And then that's when I became a daily drinker. I had a lot of false starts of things that might work for me in my life. I had worked all through college in daycare centers and was doing that full time. And I'm like, oh, what did I go to Berkeley for, to work in a daycare center in Fresno? And I was deep, you know, I felt like a failure. I felt like a failure, and I didn't know what to do, and I felt like everybody else had a script, and I didn't. And my brain was, the only way that it would stop yelling at me for being a failure was to point out what a failure you were. And those were the kind of two settings, me or you. And I became a daily drinker, and that became my solution. And I finally did the only thing I knew how to do, which was go back to school. And I went to UCLA, and I had a couple great years in LA. You know, for some reason, I was a daily blackout drinker, and I got a PhD doing that. So that's why I think I'm smart. And that worked for me, you know. You just sober up for a week at the end of the semester and write some papers. And I studied critique. That's it. I critique things. And for an alcoholic, that's a great job. That's what I know how to do. I have a very large bibliography that will allow me to critique everything. And that's it. They pay me for that. And I loved, this is what I loved the most, was the feeling after a seminar, you know, I always identify the other drunks in the class, and we go to the bar, and about the third drink, we were the smartest people in the world. You know, we were the smartest people in the world. And I loved that feeling. I loved that feeling. I don't know, that was it for me. And then I overshot the mark, and then I was the dumbest person in the room. But I that was what it felt like when it worked. You know, I liked it that my brain would shut up. I liked it that I felt smart and that everything felt like I felt powerful. That to me, that felt really powerful. It felt really good. But then I'd get mean. You know, put a few drinks in me and I'm actually really mean. I will tell you what I really think about you because I don't know why. Because that's what happens. You know, I don't know why. But I got kicked out of a lot of apartments. There were a lot of people in graduate school who hated me, who really hated me. You know, like you could either be my friend or not, but you had to pick because you couldn't, like, be my friend and be friends of any of these people who hated me. And for good reason, you know. But I didn't see it at the time as good reason. I was the victim. I was, you know. Everybody was horrible to me and nobody understood me. And if I really thought about how I brought it on myself, that was unbearable. There was just, you know, it wasn't really that interesting. It was the same thing over and over again. I was miserable, and I wanted to die. That was the truth. And what I knew how to do was to be smarter than you. And I felt like there was nothing inside of me. I just felt like I was hollow. Like I was hollow, and I didn't want anybody very close to me, because it. I just didn't. I don't know why. You know, I was like this, you know. And if you came close to me, I would rip you up pretty soon. If you got vulnerable with me, you'd regret it actually. And that's the way I lived for many years. That's the way I lived. You know, I was. People were afraid of me, and. I got a job. I teach at San Diego State, and people were afraid of me there too, and they didn't like me, and they were trying to fire me, which I deserved. I taught stoned every day because how do you get out of bed without a bong hit? I mean, how would you do it? It's the morning is a very complicated chemical process. You know, the balance of caffeine and nicotine and marijuana, it's got to be taken care of. And, you know, but I wouldn't drink around my family because, you know, my dad was a drunk and I was better than that. So pot brownies were the way to go on family vacation so that I could be loaded and feel superior, which was my, you know, that was really the position that I sought. That was, that was my solution. You know, that was my solution, and I was a blackout drinker almost every night. I needed my brain to stop because my brain was incessant. It was either attacking me or it was attacking you. And I would lie in bed. If I hadn't blacked out, I would call it. I didn't call it at the time, but later when I got, I just thought it was life. I just thought I was an unhappy person. But now I look back on it as my altar of suffering, and I would replay every night all the wrongs ever done to me. Until I could have a good cry and then take some drugs and go to sleep, you know. I just thought I was that person. And I didn't think alcohol had anything to do with my problems. I didn't think any of my problems were related to alcohol. My problems were caused by you bitches, you know, and you sons of bitches. They were not related to alcohol. It never even occurred to me that my problems were related to alcohol, honestly. I did not think I was an alcoholic. I remember one time, you know, after I got a job, I really had a double life. I had people that I drank with and the people that I worked with. Because one thing that I knew is that if I could not have a drink with people that I worked with, because anything could happen. You know, and after about 3 months at my job, I realized, like, don't start. I read somewhere, somebody's talking about alcoholics and, you know, in Washington, D.C., and that there were two kinds, the people who drank at, you know, political functions and the people who drank after they were over. And I thought, yeah, I should be the second kind. And that's what I learned to do, you know, because once I have one drink, anything can happen. Maybe, you know, I might be fine. That's the confusing part, is that I might have a real normal night and just play some, you know, Joni Mitchell and cry a little bit and just have a regular normal night. But anything can happen, really. I might call somebody I haven't seen in 10 years and tell them what I really think about them. It's like everybody's eager for me to call. Or, you know, I did a lot of drunk dialing calling or whatever. Anything could happen. You know, I could sleep with your husband. I could sleep with your wife. Anything could happen if you put a drink in me. I could fight with you. You know, I could fall in love with you. There's no telling what will happen if I have a drink. If I have one drink, it's on. It's just, and so I learned to have a double life. You know, I would work and do what needed to be done, and then I would go to Ocean Beach and drink with people who drank like I drank. Or worse, I like to drink with people who drank worse than me so that I could remain superior and be loaded. my best, my favorite, you know, position. I want to be better than you. And if you have drugs for me, that's even better. But I wanted to die. You know, I was a hope to die drunk. I just wanted to die. I never wanted to get out of bed. And I didn't know how it turned out like this. You know, I couldn't figure out. I graduated from Berkeley, and it wasn't turning out right. And I was so lonely. I was so lonely. When I came into the rooms and you guys talked about loneliness, there are parts in the book that talk about that, you know, the loneliness and despair, the four horsemen, and I recognized that. You know, you were really talking about what I felt like. People would share from the heart about what it felt like, and I didn't think I was an alcoholic, but you guys understood how lonely I was. And, I mean, I came in like this. There are people in this room who saw me come in, and I came in like, you just back up. Don't quit giving me those little pieces of paper with your name and phone number on it. Like, you know, and I'll tell you what happened was that, so I decided to quit smoking. January 1st of 1998, and after 2 days, I realized that if I was going to quit smoking, I would have to cut back on my drinking. And by January 6th, I realized I could not cut back on my drinking. And, you know, my dad was an alcoholic, and his drinking caused so many of my problems that I wasn't going to be one. And between January 6th and October 18th, I wasn't going to drink every day. Every day was the day. You know, I'm a pretty strong-willed person, and every day I wasn't going to drink, and I kept getting drunk. And let me also say, the other thing that was happening was that it wasn't working, which meant I would get loaded, and my head was still talking to me. You know, I was falling down, and my head was still talking to me. And what I wanted was that moment when it shut up. I wanted my head to be quiet. I would have done anything for my head to be quiet. And, you know, the last year that I drank, my head probably got quiet without blacking out. Like, there were probably three nights that I can remember when my head was quiet, that I wasn't in a complete blackout. And so it also wasn't working. And there was a lot of incarceration in my immediate circle. And so I thought, okay, I can do this. You know, I can stop drinking. And I'll tell you what, I couldn't. I couldn't. I kept trying. And I wasn't even trying to stop smoking pot because non-addictive marijuana is natural. I mean, that wasn't even on the agenda. So, of course, how would you get out of bed without a bong hit? I mean, that was not even, like, don't even talk to me about that. And I still could not drink. And it was so humbling. It was really 10 very humbling months of just absolute failure every day. Now I'm really not going to drink. I'm going to have only wine coolers. I'm only having beer, which I don't really like, you know. Taking a trip, not taking a trip. And I was so miserable when I didn't drink. It was unbearable. You know, the days when I would stay sober and I would go to bed without any alcohol between me and myself, I just wanted to die so much. I just thought, how come I can't die? You know? There is a line from a Bonnie Raitt song, and Bonnie knows what it's like to suffer from this disease, and she sings about it. And she says, you know how it is with me, baby. You know, I just can't stand myself. And it takes a whole lot of medicine for me to pretend that I'm somebody else. And I go, that was me. That was me. It took a whole lot of medicine for me to pretend that I was somebody else. And when I was trying to quit drinking on my own, it was the worst. It was the worst time of my life. And everything looked the same on the outside. I still top stoned. I mean, it wasn't like I was showing up in life any different, but I was just, I was dying. You know, I was praying to die. I couldn't not drink, and I couldn't bear being sober. And so in that period of time, a stray cat came into my house and had kittens, and I had a little kitten that survived that, and and his name was Ranger, because he was the Lone Ranger, and I love my cats. And it was a beautiful October day, and even though he was just this big, I left the front door open because I was going to watch him, and then somehow I got loaded, and then the neighbors were pounding on the door, and it was 9 o'clock, and I was dozing on the couch, and my kitten was dead in the road because I had left the door wide open, and a little tiny kitten wandered out and wandered in the road and got hit by a car. And I borrowed a shovel from the neighbors, and I buried that cat, and I knew I'd killed that cat. I mean, my negligence, because I was drunk, because I wasn't going to get drunk, but of course I got drunk, you know, because that's what we do. And it was so apparent to me, and I want to back up a couple days here, because as I was hoping to die, I prayed, I must tell you in all of this, I was atheist, communist, so whatever. The atheist part is the important part, and I hated religion, all religious people, and everything every church had ever done, and da-da-da-da-da, and I had a critique. But I prayed for the first time since I was a girl. I said, God, please help me to forgive myself and others, because I couldn't take it, you know? I hated myself, and I hated you, and I couldn't back off of either of those resentments that just ran my life, running from those two trains of thought, how much I hated myself and how much I hated you. And that was my prayer. God, please help me to forgive myself and others. And then a couple days later, my cat got killed, and I went to work the next day, and I went in the office of a colleague who had gotten sober a couple years before, after a night of drinking with me, which I had a resentment about. And I opened my mouth. I told him my cat had died, and I opened my mouth to say something else, and instead, I asked him to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I freaked myself out because I didn't think those words before I said them. I had never thought that. I had never thought, let me ask Stu to take me to a meeting. I never thought it. The words came out, and I was so freaked out to have words come out of my mouth that I had not thought that I went, because, I mean, now I sponsor people, and words come out of my mouth that I don't think a lot. I mean, I'm used to it now, but that was that was the first time, and, Two of my coworkers took me to a meeting, took me to Drunks Only, and I heard somebody say there when they called on him, he passed. And that's what I heard that meeting. I learned I could pass. I was so glad. But I kept going back. He introduced me to a woman who he knew in recovery who became my sponsor, because she was the first woman I met in recovery, and she offered, and I, she had a PhD, so she was smarter than other people, and that mattered. And I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really didn't hear a lot of what you said. I would sit in meetings, and I would imagine what it would be like if you put, like, all of you guys in BevMo. Like, what would, you know, if you put, like, a bunch of liquor in the middle of the room. I just sat there trying to imagine you drunk. What kind of drunks were you? You know, like who'd be taking off her shirt and who'd be wanting to fight the tall guy. And that's kind of what I did at the meetings for the beginning. I just, I don't know. I didn't have anywhere else to go. And you were so kind to me. You were so kind to me. Every time, unfailingly, people were kind to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you told me that I could come back. You said, keep coming back. I said, okay. Nobody else really wanted me to come back, and you kept... I'd just babble, and you'd say, great share. And I didn't really, you know, I did what you told me, because I didn't have anything else to do, you know, and maybe I got struck willing. I wanted to drink. I did. The desire did not immediately leave me. That was not my experience. I've heard other people, but I wanted to drink. I needed a drink. But I don't know, I felt like I had humiliated myself so far as to come into Alcoholics Anonymous that I just couldn't go any lower, you know? I just... Oh, and I didn't like it. I didn't like it. I mean, you were kind to me, but I don't really like happy people. I thought people who weren't criticizing just weren't paying attention. You know, and I thought that you guys just weren't paying attention. That was what I thought about you. I thought, God, if I could just have a real conversation with somebody in AA, but they keep talking about gratitude. But, you know, I kept coming back, and you kept being nice to me. And then I'll tell you what happened. I had about a year sober, and I got a cold. And let me say, I didn't really want to share because I was afraid that you were going to ask me to leave because my bottom wasn't low enough. You know, because my bottom wasn't low enough. And that if you heard my story, you'd say that I didn't belong here. And I took a lot of comfort in the third tradition that says the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And, you know, I didn't want to be my dad. I wanted something different. You know, I wanted what you had. The first time I walked into Mesa Women's and some people who saw me come in there are here. And there were these women there, and I wanted what they had. You know, they had so much dignity, and they had themselves. You know, they were full people. They weren't just a script and a hollow center. They were full people, and they had so much compassion for themselves and others, and they just, I wanted what they had. And I've been going to that meeting ever since my first week of sobriety, without fail, if I'm in town, because I want what those women have still. And then what happened was, I got a cold, and I took nighttime cold medicine as prescribed, and it ran out at 3 in the morning. And I know that it was 3 in the morning because I would have done anything for a drink. It was just enough to wake the sleeping tiger in me. It was just enough. I want to tell you about the steps. But this is my first step. It was just enough that my disease was awake. And I tore apart my apartment looking for anything, a roach, a Xanax, a beer, anything. And I'm on the bathroom floor with, like, curlers and tampons and makeup, like, going through it like there's a pill here somewhere. And I realized, I have this thing. I have this thing. I just saw it. It was the obsession, you know? It was the obsession. I had just enough in my body. And that was really, like, I had been doing my steps and writing, but that was when the first step did me. And then I learned that I take the steps, and then the steps take me. You know, like, I do them. And then there's a point in time when the thing happens in me. And that was really about a year into sobriety when I really in my heart took my first step, when I really knew that, like, I have this thing. And it was a relief, you know, because I had one foot in the door. I didn't know where else to go, but I didn't really think that I belonged here. And then after that, I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, after that, I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I really knew that I had this thing. Step two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I just hadn't have any interest in God. I didn't. But I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. you know? And you were a power greater than me because you were sober. You were apparently quite happy without a drink. And that was a power greater than me. And your unfailing kindness to me really was my higher power. It was, you know, I go to the same meeting week after week, and the same people would be there just being nice, just being pleasant, nothing big, nothing flashy. The people who just sat in the same chair, got a cup of coffee for the guy next to them. You know, one of the things that really carried the message to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to go to Mission Hills Beginners, and there's a guy there, if you've been to that meeting, Chris, who's a little developmentally disabled. And when the meeting is being introduced, Chris shouts out something which was completely unintelligible to me and disrupts the meeting. And everybody in the meeting says, "Hi, Chris." And the meeting goes on. And I thought, everybody's welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could stay. You know, if Chris could stay, I could stay. And Alcoholics Anonymous was my higher power the first time through the steps. And when I came to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood God, you know, what my sponsor explained to me was the important word there is a decision. It's about making a decision, you know? And I said, how do I know that I've made the decision? And then she said, you do the rest of the steps, you know? And I've learned with time as it goes on that that's a decision I have to make over and over and over again. I wish I always felt the closeness of God in my heart. Mostly, I decide to act like a woman who believes in God. I think, if somebody believed in God, how would they behave? Well, let me do that. Let me do that, you know? That's step three to me, and that I made a decision. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of a power greater than myself. It doesn't say, really felt great about it. I just made a decision. And then I did step four. And I didn't mind. I liked writing, and I hated myself, so I was really happy to write all my wrongs. So that was easy. I didn't have any problem telling people that what I, you know. But I'll tell you, I read it to my sponsor, and what I learned was that I am a fear-based person. What I learned was that almost everything in my life was motivated by fear. I did not know that. I really didn't know that until I did my first fourth step, that it was fear that drove me to almost everything in my life. It was so surprising to me to learn a basic fact about myself, you know, when I was 40. Like, wow, I'm a fear-based person. I am afraid of everything, and mostly I'm afraid that I'm unlovable. You know, I'm afraid of what you think of me. I'm afraid that if I'm not perfect at everything, I can't even be in the room. I'm afraid you're going to kick me to the curb if I mess up once. You know, I got to be top of the heap or bottom of the pile. I'm afraid there's no place for me. I'm afraid. I'm afraid. I'm afraid. I didn't think I was afraid. I thought I was pretty tough. I didn't think I was afraid. But I learned that doing my fourth step. But I really want to talk, though, with the time that remains about the sixth and seventh steps, because to me, they are the heart of the program. They are the heart of the program. I was asked recently, what's the hardest step for me? And by a friend who doesn't really know the program, and I told her about the steps, and first she's like, really? That keeps you sober? Wow. But I said the sixth step is the hardest because my character defects, my fear, my self-pity, my pride, my need to be right, they were my solution. You see, that was me. That was me. And without them, I was nothing. You know, it wasn't like there was another essential Doreen ready to rush in when I let go of this. It turned out there was, but I didn't believe that. I thought I would disappear. If my character defects disappeared, I would disappear. And so I drug my feet on step six for a really long time because they were me. I didn't want to let them go. I didn't want to let my self-pity and my fear and my pride go because then I would be the hole in the donut. And I got in enough pain that I became that I begged, you know, but it took me a long time to go from seeing what my character defects were to getting ready to beg to have them removed. And that was really painful. I did a long step. And what I was taught was that I asked God to remove them and then I acted as if they had been removed. You know, I was taught this is a program of action. You know, I asked that when I really ask that my problems get removed, it means I got to turn way over here to the solution. If I, you know, I have to take contrary action. I have to act as if they've been removed. I have to take moderate action in the opposite direction of my instincts, which are fear and pride. And so that I have to act with God. God will remove them, and I have to act as if they've been removed. That's the way I was shown step 6 and step 7. And what I've learned in this program is that God does the heavy lifting. You know, you can pack up your character defects and you can put them on the front porch, and the ones that are do not serve God or me or my fellows get taken away. God does the heavy lifting, and I was changed. I was changed. It turns out I am not an unhappy person. You know, I didn't know that. I'm not afraid most of the time anymore. If I'm not playing cards, can occasionally be humble. But when cards are being played, it's all out the window. You know, but I have an ability to love other people, and I can feel it when other people love me. I can be, you know, a person among people, a worker among workers. I can be a part of this fellowship. I have something to offer, and I was changed. You know, I took contrary action. I took a lot of action. Don't get me wrong. I work this program. I love this program. I took a lot of action. But if I had been able to become unafraid on my own, I would have done it. If I had been able to, you know, be relieved of my unhappiness on my own, believe me, I would have done it. So first God removed the need to drink. God gave me a choice in the matter of drink. And then God gave me a choice in so many other things. One by one, I got choice in so many things. And, you know, I usually made the wrong choice 4 or 5 times sober, but whatever. I got choices in all manner of things in my life, one by one, by working the steps on them. And I was able to make amends. You know, if you've done a thorough 6 and 7 step, the amends aren't that bad because you're not that person anymore. And you can look that person in the eye and you know that, like, it's not just another drunk saying, I'm sorry. It's done. That person's done. You know, and I got to make amends to my father. He had open heart surgery, and I took a week off of work, and I went and took care of him. And during that week, I made amends to him. And I don't know, he is who he is, and I am who I am. But I think our relationship is healed in a lot of ways. I don't hate him. He doesn't occupy my mind. I've forgiven him. I was listening to the radio, and there was this country song about a dad singing about how his daughter's getting married and how no one would ever love his daughter as much as him. And I was just like, pity pot, like, oh, God, my dad would never sing that song about me. But my second thought was, but a lot of other people love me. You know, he's just one person. And it passed. And that's the great miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I was able to let it go without him changing one bit. You know, because a lot of other people love me, and I can feel it. A lot of other people love me, and I can feel it. And I think I'm out of time. I just want to say that, you know, please, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And if you don't take the first drink, you won't have to take any of the others. And if you aren't sure if you belong here, please keep coming back until you catch the disease of alcoholism. Because once you have alcoholism, then you have a solution. You know? So I just want to really tell people that just sometimes we think we can go in and out. And it's not always true. You know, it's not always true. So if you have a seat in the room today, I hope you keep it. I hope you keep it, even if you don't feel like it. Even if, you know, you're really hating us and you think we're way too happy. Just, you know, don't drink and come back. And someone's going to tell your story. And please don't leave before the miracle happens because, you know, you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. God makes all things right. Great things will come to pass. Thank you very much.